Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings, this is Abayomi Ezekwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. Today is Saturday, September 13th, 2014. We're broadcasting live from our studios here in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to today's Pan-African Journal. We'll be right back with more of this week's program. Abayomi Ezekwe, and welcome back to the Pan-African Journal for this week. And this week's program will be coming up a little bit later with our regular Pan-African Newswire reports. Also, we will be bringing you the New York City version of the Pan-African Journal, hosted by yours truly and produced by Bernard White from Community Progressive Radio in New York City. Also, later on in our program, we'll be commemorating the 33rd anniversary of the Attica Uprising of 1971 in New York State. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week.
Mobelia que nena foto yo, Mobelia que nena foto oh, a que le coye cola oh, a que le quie si cae alisano, a que le motaco oh, oye niñe. Esikaya lisano moto nyoso asakanaka. Esikaya mawa moto nyoso alilaka. Ngaina lili mobalye akene motako. Oya ninye nakuti na lopango bato bazali kolela. Ngai na bandi na ngai fe kolela. Kolela na ngai mawa ya mobali. Mawa na ngai ya sisteme ye. Mawa na ngai ya sisto ye. Ako songa sanda nini ye. Ako songa mula nini ye.
Oyo nini ye.
Kanana yo ozali kotina, bongo papa ozali kotina, na telefone ozali kosolola, mbote na famille ozali kopesa, na lingi presence, nga na lingi presence ya bomoto na yo papa.
Oyo ninye, eh.
Boya makambo ezali minene, boya makambo ezali minene, Franco abeleli na Amerika oh oh, Franco abeleli na Brussels oh oh, Franco abeleli na Paris eh, balobi makambo ezali minene, makambo ezali minene eh. Na sengi dodo nzela nga na bima, dodo andimeli nga na motema, nga na bimi mambo na butu, na kuti dodo na maboko ya manda na ngai, misozo ba e salite,
makambo e sali minene eh.
Motema eli nga
nenge nini e eh.
Makanisi ya vana
nenge nini ye.
Motema ya boya
nenge nini ye.
Moli monati ya
yango wapi ye.
Dodo a dese warna ye. Alongo lingai nesika na lingaka ye.
Makambo ezali minene ye.
Azala kana susina motema mama, yango na koma komela mingi ye, yango na koma kwiti kwiti ye, pona longola susia mobali yo, akoma na kamarade na ngai elusala ye.
Makambo ezali minene ye.
Boya
makambo ezali minene
Boya
makambo ezali minene
Franco
ape beleli na America o oh, o oh.
Franco
a beleli na Brussels o oh, o oh.
Franco
a beleli na Paris e eh, eh.
Balobi
maka mwezali binene e eh. Maka mwezali binene e eh.
Greetings once again. This is Abayomi Ezekwe, and welcome back to the Pan-African Journal for this week. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. If you're interested in getting access to this program as well as other archived editions of the Pan-African Journal, all you have to do is log on to our website at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll be right back with more of this week's program.
Sana loko la ozonga e bandeko.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, and we're here on Saturday, September 13th, 2014. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to the Pan-African Journal for this week. In this week's program, we'll be coming up with our Pan-African Newswire reports, where we will provide you information about some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day. In today's Pan-African Newswire, we have features on developments in the West African state of Sierra Leone. Also, developments taking place in Ferguson, Missouri, in the aftermath of one of the most significant urban rebellions in the United States for some time, as well as other issues. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back with more of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal.
Bambana na suana mokili kaka neva mojiki nangai mambanda na zuana mokili baleki na bande konangai na tike la bangoli bala mobali na lingaka na tiki karche na bino ya babei na songi songi na koma na ngai na kinga salie na zuana ngai moteki senga na poya konkeronce na basi ya kilo na sukola ye akoma mafe repose nango.
once again. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. Welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. And right now we're going to move into our regular Pan-African Newswire reports for this week. And in this week's Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal, we'll be discussing the current situation in the East African nation of Uganda, where the U.S. allied regime of Yoweri Museveni has stepped up security at hotels and public places after allegedly foiling a, quote, terror plot, unquote. Now, Ugandan police said today that security was being stepped up at hotels and public places after authorities foiled a suspected, quote, terror plot, unquote, in the center of the capital of Kampala. Quote, we're increasing patrols in the city, major towns, and other vulnerable places, unquote, said Fred Enanga, a spokesman for the Ugandan police. He told this to a press conference in Kampala. The United States Embassy in Uganda had earlier issued a statement saying the Ugandan authorities had uncovered a, quote, terrorist cell, unquote, run by the Somali Islamist organization Al-Shabaab, which they believed was planning an imminent attack. It told U.S. citizens to seek shelter while the authorities carry out an operation against the suspected cell. In the West African state of Sierra Leone, the government has requested funds for the fight against the Ebola virus disease. Sierra Leone has requested funds from the World Health Organization to evacuate a doctor who is ill with the deadly Ebola disease. Dr. Olivette Buck is the fourth doctor from Sierra Leone to come down with Ebola, which has been blamed for 2,400 deaths in West Africa, according to the World Health Organization. Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea-Conakry have recorded the vast majority of the Ebola virus disease cases. Buck, a citizen of Sierra Leone, would be the first doctor from one of the countries hit hardest by Ebola to receive treatment outside the country. The other three doctors from Sierra Leone died inside the country. A letter from President Ernest Bai Koroma's office said he had approved Buck's evacuation to a hospital in Hamburg, Germany, quote, where they are in readiness to receive her, unquote. The letter sent to the World Health Organization's country representative on Friday, September the 12th, and seen Saturday, September the 13th, by the Associated Press, said Buck tested positive for Ebola on Tuesday. Quote, we have been informed that Dr. Buck is quite ill, unquote, it said. The World Health Organization did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Because Ebola is only transmitted through contact with the bodily fluids of people showing symptoms or from dead bodies of Ebola victims, health workers have been especially vulnerable as they respond to the worst outbreak in history. More than 135 health workers have died so far, exacerbating shortages of doctors and nurses in West African countries already hindered by shortages of health workers. So far, only foreign aid and health workers have been evacuated abroad for treatment from Sierra Leone and Liberia. Dr. Sheikh Umar Khan, Sierra Leone's top Ebola doctor, was being considered for evacuation to a European country when he died of the disease in late July. Cuba's health ministry announced on Friday, September the 12th, it will send more than 160 health workers to fight Ebola in Sierra Leone, a move that the World Health Organization Director General Dr. Margaret Chan said would, quote, make a significant difference, unquote. And with that, we're going to conclude this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal, the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. And we'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service designed to foster intelligent discussion on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998 and has published thousands of articles and dispatches in newspapers and magazines and journals and research reports and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. And if you are interested in logging on to the Pan-African Newswire, all you have to do is log on to panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And we'd like to remind our listeners as well If you're interested in logging on to this program, the Pan-African Journal, all you have to do is log on to blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll be right back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week.
Nazali innocent, mama e, ma pena e moko, mama e, likambo ya kobota. Nazali innocent, mama e, basumu na e moko, mama e. Ongana na sakango na bimisaka, binobo kamata sima bobenga ngai mbanda onaseki, sango na koyoka. Nazali innocent, mama e, mabe na ye moko, mama e, likambo ya kobota. Nazali innocent, mama e, masumu na ye moko, mama e. Nakufeli bolingo na baby silo kumwe, matekina mobiba.
And welcome back. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. And the Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. And we'll be right back with more of this week's program.
Distant past, and now, in our troubled present, For to fail to do so leaves our people at the not too tender mercies of a system that has demonstrated a kind of vehemence and animosity that few populations in America have suffered from similarly. For ultimately, a profession is just that, a claim to act a certain way in the world according to certain stated norms and codes that a certain area of employment must abide by. Except in the long memory of Black America, we know better. We must know, as did the esteemed Black journalist Frederick Douglass, that a constitution written on parchment would differ greatly from government and legal practice when it came to Black people. They were promises, promises broken and unfulfilled for over a century after the Supreme Court decided in the Plessy decision that separate but equal was good enough. Black journalist Ida B. Wells Barnett worked long and hard to bring light to the lies used to justify lynchings against Black people, so much so that, according to recent scholarship, she was shunned and avoided by leading lights of the early civil rights movement who regarded her as too militant, too outspoken. Meanwhile, under the Tilden-Hayes Gentlemen's Agreement, white terrorism expressed by lynching was the peculiar American custom that wasn't spoken of in polite society. So quietly, except for Wells, Black bodies hung and burned by the thousands across America, the courts and law deeming it mere local custom beyond their control. When we enter the modern era, we see a panorama of Black pain that is as unprecedented as it is silent. I speak of mass incarceration, the targeting, imprisonment, and criminalization of dark people in ways and numbers the world has never seen for decades. And until recent days, the silence, even among Black journalists, has been deafening. Recently, the New York Times has editorialized against it. How many Black newspapers have done so? Why not? Professionalism? A false objectivity? The late historian Howard Zinn, for years, decried the notion of professionalism. In a speech in Colorado in 2006, Zinn said, "We all go into professions where you're supposed to be professional, and to be professional means that you don't step outside of your profession. If you're an artist, you don't take a stand on political issues. If you're a professor, you don't give your opinions in the classroom. If you're a newspaper man, you pretend to be objective in presenting the news. But of course, it's all false. You cannot be neutral." In Zinn's words, you can't be neutral on a moving train. As journalists, the choices before you are actually quite clear. Follow the dictates of your bosses or serve the interests of your people. Black America, in the main, lives a life of daily hell. For them, freedom is a word, but prison is an inevitability. For them, civil rights are a mirage and daily humiliations are a certainty. For all the powers of the state are arrayed against them. They know this, as do we. But such lived realities rarely flow from our pens, our mouths, or our fingers. So we write dross on the lifestyles of the rich and famous, or some blathering from a politician, while our people suffer. The choice for any journalist should be clear. I thank you, NADJ. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And that was the voice of the voiceless, Mumia Abu-Jamal, talking about the so-called profession of journalism in the United States today. And Mumia Abu-Jamal is still serving a life sentence in the Pennsylvania criminal justice system. No longer on death row, but still not free. The struggle to free Mumia Abu-Jamal continues. And right now we want to turn our attention to the Pan-African Journal, New York City version, that was aired just this last past Monday, September 8th, 2014. Over CPR Metro, the community progressive radio station based in New York City. This Pan-African Journal, New York City version, is hosted by yours truly, Abayomi Ezekwe, and produced by Bernard White of CPRMetro.org. Let's listen in to the Pan-African Journal, New York City version from September 8th, earlier this week. Greetings once again. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. Welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. In this week's Pan-African Journal, we're going to be discussing the following issues. The outbreak of an Ebola virus in West Africa is having both a political and economic impact on several regional states. As of now, over 4,000 cases have been officially reported, and there have been many deaths in the West Africa region. In the Southern African nation of Lesotho, the Prime Minister Tom Tabane has been escorted back into the country by the South African police services. Lesotho was threatened with a military coup earlier in the month. In the East African nation of Somalia, the United States has engaged in an airstrike that resulted in the death of the leader of the Al-Shabaab resistance organization fighting against the U.S.-backed government in Mogadishu. The U.S. has periodically engaged in strikes against Al-Shabaab over the last 6 years. And finally, the military situation inside of eastern Ukraine has been subjected to a ceasefire that was negotiated in the Belarus capital of Minsk. Nonetheless, there's fighting still reported in Ukraine. This is taking place at the same time that the conclusion of the recently held NATO meeting authorized further military actions against Ukraine as well as against the Middle Eastern nation of Iraq. In West Africa, the United Nations has sent what has been called a, quote, an international rescue, unquote, call to respond to the Ebola outbreak throughout the region. The United Nations says it is establishing a, quote, Ebola crisis center, unquote, with the goal of stopping transmission in affected countries within 6 to 9 months and preventing the international spread of the virus. Speaking to the press after an emergency meeting with the United Nations leaders just this last past Friday, September the 5th, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon noted that $600 million is urgently needed to provide supplies to combat Ebola in West Africa. He again urged airlines and shipping industries and countries to lift their ban on flights and port visits so doctors, nurses, beds, medical equipment, and supplies can reach those in need. The World Health Organization, the WHO, said on Friday, blood-derived products and serum from survivors may be used to treat the Ebola virus immediately, and two vaccines could be available for health workers by the end of this year. But good clinical care, rigorous infection prevention and control measures, and the tracing of people who have been exposed remain crucial for ending the epidemic. The death toll in the Ebola outbreak in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone totaled 2,097 as of September the 5th, out of nearly 4,000 cases. A further 8 people have died in the West African state of Nigeria, Africa's most populous, and there is one confirmed case in the West African state of Senegal. That puts the death toll at a total of 2,105 as of September the 5th, and the number of patients infected so far as high as 3,968. Now, according to a study that was conducted by the Center for African Democratic Affairs, the CADA, it says that the current outbreak of Ebola may inflict broad economic damage on most West African countries if the situation is not contained as soon as possible. It further observed that the outbreak could have a direct financial effect on government budgets by increasing health expenditures significantly and creating an Ebola-induced economic slowdown on government revenue generation in a region where budgets were already hindered by low tax collection, corruption, mismanagement, as well as bad governance. Now, these concerns were contained in a press release signed by Mr. Frank Adarkwa Yodum, the executive director of the Center for African Democratic Affairs. It was also copied to the Ghana News Agency just this last past Tuesday. The center expressed worry that commercial and transport disruptions may also be experienced in the region soon, along with the increased health expenditures, which might put pressure on budgets and jeopardize economic growth. The report noted that one of the first casualties of an epidemic like Ebola in any economy has often been the tourism sector, and that the region will soon start feeling the impact of the Ebola scare on tourism, with majority of tourists diverting from the region to other destinations. The press release said, and we quote, "The Center for African Democratic Affairs has gathered that Caterpillar, an American company, has evacuated a handful of its employees from Liberia, that the Canadian Overseas Petroleum Limited has suspended a drilling project, that Kenyan Airways has suspended its flights to all the Ebola-hit West African countries, and the British Airways is canceling flights to a number of countries in West Africa due to the current outbreak of Ebola. The center has also learned that the ExxonMobil and Chevron corporations are waiting to see whether health officials can contain the danger," unquote, the release said. According to the press release, the World Bank estimates that the outbreak could shrink economic growth in Guinea, where the crisis emerged in March, from 4.5% to 3.5% this year. So far, the Ebola outbreak, which has claimed more than 1,300 lives, disrupted commercial activity in the affected areas and wreaked economic damage in countries like Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, though some analysts have argued that the crisis doesn't threaten the broader African or global economies. Now, the center called on governments to walk a fine line between containing the spread of Ebola and causing needless disruption. Quote, "Panic is avoided not just by combating an epidemic, but by being seen to do so," unquote, it maintained. Therefore, the outbreak of Ebola in West Africa is causing problems that extend far beyond the healthcare sector. And of course, it is these developments that will, in the long term, impact not only those countries in the region, but also the international community's response to the outbreak. This outbreak, of course, has caused panic in many regions of West Africa where governments have imposed quarantines on people. In the West African state of Nigeria, in a report that was issued on September the 3rd, it's important to note that there are seven reported deaths in the West African state of Nigeria. Also in Rivers State, a female patient reportedly died from the disease just this last past week. One patient was discharged and two still remain in isolation. Now, according to an article that was published by Vincent Ikumola in Abuja, the political capital of the West African state of Nigeria, and this article was published in the Nation newspaper in Nigeria, the number of deaths from the Ebola virus disease in the country has increased to seven. The latest to die of the virus is a female patient who was on admission in the same hospital with the Port Harcourt Dr. Ike Inumua, the Minister of Health, Professor Onye Buche Chukwu, disclosed the death of the female patient in his latest update on the virus in the country. Quote, total numbers of deaths from the Ebola virus disease in Nigeria is now 7. The index case occurred in a private hospital in Lagos. 4, in the Lagos isolation ward. 1, in the Port Harcourt isolation ward. The female patient who was on admission in the same hospital where the late Port Harcourt doctor was also admitted, while another one was the doctor who was infected by the ECOWAS commission official in Port Harcourt, who did not come under the care and management of the incident management committee, unquote. He also noted that another patient was, however, discharged following full recovery from the ailment. The latest discharge brings to 8 the number of patients discharged so far. The latest case to be discharged, the minister stated in a press statement issued by his media aide, Mr. Dan Nwome, quote, is the first secondary contact to be diagnosed and a spouse of a primary contact of the index case, unquote. He stated she went home from the isolation ward in Lagos last week on Tuesday. The 9th survivor is the ECOWAS commission official who jumped surveillance in Lagos and traveled to Port Harcourt, where he infected the doctor who attended to him, unquote. Also confirmed cases in the country is now 18, according to the Minister of Health's update. The 18th confirmed case, he stated, is the sister of a late Port Harcourt doctor. Total number of cases successfully managed and discharged is now up to 8 in the West African state of Nigeria. While the total number of Ebola virus disease patients currently under treatment is 2, one in the Lagos isolation ward and another one in the Port Harcourt isolation ward. The total number of contacts currently under surveillance in Lagos is 41, while Port Harcourt has 255, and the total number of contacts discharged in Lagos after they were observed for 21 days is a total of 320. The minister also debunked rumors of the Ebola virus disease cases outside of Lagos and Port Harcourt. These include the 3 reported cases in the Federal Capital Territory and 1 case in Calabar. The minister further debunked the story that the body of the late Port Harcourt doctor was transported to Edo or Delta State, saying the body has been decontaminated and will be interned in Port Harcourt. On the rumored case in Zaria, the minister stated that the blood sample has been seen for the Ebola testing. And that was a report on developments taking place in the West African state of Nigeria as they tackle the issue of combating the outbreak of the Ebola virus, which has spread through many countries in West Africa. It purportedly had its origin in the West African state of Guinea. It has spread into Sierra Leone and Liberia. We mentioned earlier that there were cases that were identified in Nigeria and the possibility of one death there. There's also been reports of one possible case in the northern region of the Democratic Republic of Congo. And with that, we're going to conclude this segment of the Pan-African Journal. We'll be right back with more of this week's program. Welcome back. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. And in the Southern African nation of Lesotho, an attempted military coup d'etat that took place last week has been the point of discussion in the Republic of South Africa. Inside the Republic of South Africa, the Lesotho Prime Minister fled there over a week ago in threat of being surrounded and possibly detained and even possibly killed. Of course, the situation in Lesotho has been described as calm this week, and Prime Minister Tom Tabane, who had fled to the Republic of South Africa, is now back in Lesotho at his residence, and he was escorted there by the South African police sources. Now, according to a news analysis that was published recently by author Lisel Luo Vardron, he raises the question, why Lesotho? As shots rang out in the capital of the Mountain Kingdom last weekend, many were wondering why interference in politics by the Lesotho Army is such a recurring occurrence in the country. Now, of the 15 member states of the Southern African Development Community, the small country of Lesotho is the one most prone to coups and attempted coups. Analysts say a largely unchecked military and complicated electoral system that lends itself to personal rivalry could be the cause of the unrest. Andre Rao, a senior researcher at the Institute for Security Studies in Pretoria, says a small army led by a handful of generals who have become a law unto themselves in Lesotho is, quote, a classic recipe for a coup, unquote. Add the lack of training and insufficient civilian oversight of the Lesotho Defense Forces, and this is a volatile mix that could easily lead to instability, he says. The politicization of the army has been evident in Lesotho in the past few months. The Army Chief Lieutenant General Kladi Kamodi had, in fact, publicly threatened Prime Minister Thomas Tabane several times since the beginning of the political strife among the coalition partners in the country earlier this year. His sacking by Tabane last week is considered to be one of the reasons for the latest unrest. Quote, you have the appointment of a new chief of staff, and the incumbent is visibly unhappy about it, unquote, says Rao. Those siding with Tabane, however, say the Army's intervention this time is linked to Tabane's anti-corruption drive. Tabane's political rival, Deputy Prime Minister Motsejoa Metsing, appeared in court last month on charges of corruption, which he claims are unfounded and part of a smear campaign against him. The meddling by the military and politics in Lesotho can be compared with that of several smaller West African states that regularly fall victims to coup d'etats, says Rao. Of the member states of the Economic Community of West African States, only Senegal has never experienced a military coup in its post-colonial history. Souhau Plekane, director of the Transformation Research Center in Maseru, the capital of Lesotho, says professionalizing the military and drawing up a legal framework for military appointments was part of reforms instituted in the early 1990s in Lesotho. This was somewhat successful, but was eroded when a fraught electoral system led to the political crisis in 1998. South Africa then intervened in the face of a military coup, and more than 60 people were killed, including 8 South African soldiers. Plekane, who is also a research fellow at the South African Institute for International Affairs, says following the 1998 crisis, a new electoral model that combines the traditional constituency-based first-past-the-post electoral system with a proportional system was adopted. Quote, the constituency-based system does lead to more accountability to voters in a specific area, but it excludes smaller voices in parliament because it eliminates all those who lose out to the ultimate winner, unquote, he said. Now, the current instability came about following the elections in 2012 when the Democratic Congress, the DC, the party of the former Prime Minister, Pakalita Musididi, received the biggest number of seats in parliament, but smaller parties clubbed together to form a majority. The coalition partners, which include Tabane's All Basotho Convention, Metsing's Lesotho Congress for Democracy, and the smaller Basotho National Party, soon fell out, leading to all sorts of infighting. On June the 11th, an agreement was signed between the Lesotho Congress for Democracy and the Congress of Democracy. This created the likelihood of Tabane being voted out
by a motion of no confidence, and he subsequently asked King Letsia III for permission to suspend Parliament. The suspension was granted for a period of up to 9 months. Declani says the suspension was legal, according to Lesotho's constitution, and had been used twice in the past for shorter periods of time to ensure the speedy promulgation of legislation. Members of the Lesotho Coalition traveled to New Zealand in July of this year, sponsored by the Commonwealth, to study the mixed electoral system in that country, one of the few systems in the world similar to that of Lesotho. Declani, however, says the trip had been planned before the suspension of Parliament in June and was not directly linked to the collapse of the coalition. Now, in an interview with Lesotho Prime Minister Tom Tabani that was published in the South African Mail and Guardian on September the 5th, it says that the Prime Minister Tom Tabani indicated that foreign forces are keeping the peace following the attempted coup. In battle, Lesotho Prime Minister Tom Tabani admitted to feeling much safer in the presence of South African police services and intelligence agency personnel. Tabani is back in his country's top seat thanks to foreign security agencies from the Republic of South Africa. Quote, "It is the police and an element of the intelligence services," unquote, Tabani said in a telephone interview with the Mail and Guardian on Thursday afternoon, September the 4th. He went on to say that, quote, "They are not only around my residence, they are all over the country and in police stations where there was instability," unquote, he noted. But he is still the boss in Lesotho, he said. He said, quote, "I am in charge of the country. I am at the State House now. The only difference is that at the gate, it is South Africans, but they will leave as soon as things are stable," unquote. Although he failed to convince President Jacob Zuma to send the South African National Defense Forces to secure his leadership of Lesotho, he said he was satisfied that he was receiving assistance from South Africa. Tabani, who was escorted home by the South African police and a delegation of politicians chosen by the government of South Africa on Tuesday of last week, said he hoped to have his own country's police and army returning to their duties of securing the country soon. Quote, "We need to move fast because the mission here is for a limited period, just to pave the way for us to reopen Parliament and bring things back to normal," unquote. Tabani fled to South Africa for 3 days after fleeing his country before dawn last Saturday, when it became clear the army would try to topple him. But on Thursday, September the 4th, he said agreements reached through the mediation of the Southern African Development Community in Pretoria on Monday, September the 1st, were already being implemented. Quote, "I just had a meeting with the Speaker of Parliament, and he is looking at the logistics and the date of reopening Parliament," unquote, Tabani said. Quote, "It is very quiet in the country, and it is very quiet for me also where I am staying. There are no people coming in and out like they would do normally, but this is necessary because there is a security threat," unquote. Tabani admitted that it was wrong for political parties in Lesotho to allow the police and the army to get involved in politics. Lesotho police supports Tabani, whereas the army supports Deputy Prime Minister Motsoaledi Mthenge of the Lesotho Congress for Democracy, a coalition partner with Tabani's All Basotho Convention and the Basotho National Party, led by Sedidi Maserebani. Quote, "We have had a bit of a tainted past. We had started on a good note when we got independence from the British, adopting a democratic system of separating politics and security agencies," unquote, Tabani said. He went on to say that, quote, "But at some point, we had a state of emergency when the party that lost elections used the army. That culture of having politicians making those mistakes is the one that brought us here," unquote. Tabani admitted he had been caught off guard by last weekend's attempted coup. He said that, quote, "I must confess, it took me by surprise. It came as an unpleasant surprise because I thought we had been engaging on issues that we disagreed on, unquote. Quote, I am very disappointed, unquote. He did not concede, however, that there was a, quote, build-up, unquote, towards a possible coup over the past 6 months as coalition partners struggled through one disagreement after another. Although there is widespread doubt about how long the shaky coalition can hold, Tabbani insisted that only after the elections in 2017 would the government of Lesotho change. In spite of the tensions, Tabbani said coalition partners governing the country had little choice but to swallow their pride and put the country first. Quote, the trust is not negotiable. You have to carry on the work. As coalition partners, we don't have to kiss each other. There are agreements and principles, and if those principles are adhered to, we can run a clean government, unquote. Asked whether he regretted suspending parliament in June and taking decisions on his own instead with his coalition partners, which contributed to the rising tensions in the country, he said, quote, no, not at all. The processes that are unfolding now create a chance for all partners to negotiate better. Quote, we are all sober now, and it's partly thanks to the suspension of parliament, unquote. Lesotho, a mountain kingdom landlocked by South Africa, has had several coups since independence in 1966. Tabbani said he is determined to change that culture. Quote, if I live another 5 years or so, I think this should be the last incident of this kind in Lesotho. It will be like a pimple that comes on your face. When you get treatment for it, it disappears and you remain with your beautiful face, unquote. South African police officers are currently providing security for Tabbani, and Police Commissioner Kopatso Sohana, among others. Tabbani insists his chosen army commander, Lieutenant General Maparankwo Mahau, is now the real leader of the Lesotho Defense Force. The Prime Minister ordered Lieutenant General Thadi Kamoti to relinquish his command on the eve of last weekend's attempted coup. There was no relationship between the uprising and Kamoti's firing, Tabbani said. Quote, it is a coincidence. The reality is that we have done this. We have fired Kamoti constitutionally, unquote. In the early hours of last Saturday, the Lesotho Army raided police headquarters and the main station that houses the Police Special Operations Unit. Tabbani's official residence was also surrounded by soldiers. Lesotho's coalition government still has 3 more years in office before the next elections. And that was an updated report on the political and security situation inside the Southern African Kingdom of Lesotho, where the Prime Minister, Tom Tabbani, has been repatriated back into Lesotho. And, of course, he was escorted by the South African Police Services. There's a strong presence of the South African Police Services and the South African Intelligence Services inside Lesotho until the political situation is further stabilized. And with that, we'll take another brief break. We'll be right back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week. And welcome back. This is the Pan-African Journal. In the East African nation of Somalia, the leader of the Al-Shabaab resistance organization was reportedly killed as a result of United States airstrikes in that Horn of Africa state. A commander of Somalia's Islamic organization, the Al-Shabaab, confirmed on Saturday, September the 6th, that the leader of the organization was killed in the United States airstrike. Abu Muhammad said the Al-Shabaab fighters were meeting at an undisclosed location to pick a successor to Ahmed Abdi Godani, a senior Somalian intelligence officer who insisted on anonymity because he is not authorized to speak to the media, said Zakaria Ismail, who has a $3 million bounty on his head, is one of the candidates to succeed Godani. Rodani, and other al-Shabaab officials were killed by a United States airstrike on Monday, September the 1st. The strike hit the car in which he was traveling. The attack took place some 105 miles, that is 170 kilometers, south of the capital of Mogadishu, where al-Shabaab trains its fighters. President Barack Obama confirmed on Friday, September the 5th, that Rodani was killed by a United States airstrike. Rodani was also known as Mukhtar Abu Zubair and was the spiritual leader of the al-Shabaab organization. The United States had offered a reward of up to $7 million for information leading to his arrest. Rodani had publicly claimed that al-Shabaab was responsible for the deadly Westgate Mall attack in Nairobi, Kenya, that left 67 people dead a year ago. Somalia's government said on Friday, September the 5th, that it has credible intelligence that al-Shabaab is planning attacks following the death of their leader. In a televised speech, General Khalif Ahmed Erej, Somalia's national security minister, said possible targets include medical and educational institutions. Erej said the government is vigilant and its armed forces are prepared to prevent such an attack. The killing of Rodani was a, quote, delightful victory, unquote, said Egerd. He called on fighters still operating with al-Shabaab to surrender to get a, quote, brighter, unquote, life from the government. The implications for al-Shabaab following Rodani's death are unclear. Some analysts predict a power struggle for the leadership that could splinter the organization. Kenya's president, Uhuru Kenyatta, said on Saturday, September the 6th, that he thanked the United States for killing Rodani, saying his death provides, quote, a small measure of closure, unquote, for victims of the Westgate Mall attack. Kenyatta's nephew and his fiancée died in that attack a year ago this month. Rodani, who used a number of other aliases, led the planning and was responsible for the preparation of the attack on the Westgate Mall in Nairobi, Kenya, according to President of Kenya, Uhuru Kenyatta. Quote, we owe the United States and its soldiers our heartfelt thanks for bringing an end to Rodani's career of death and destruction and finally allowing us to begin our healing, unquote, the president of Kenya said. He went on to say that, quote, his death is a stark reminder that those who live by the sword shall perish by the sword, unquote. Al-Shabaab has vowed to revenge the presence of Kenyan troops in Somalia. Kenyan troops went into Somalia in October of 2011, ostensibly to fight al-Shabaab in the southern region of that troubled Horn of African nation. It is blamed for cross-border attacks and kidnappings of Westerners on Kenyan soil. Although the Kenyan Defense Forces claim that they entered Somalia in the south purely based upon its own national interests, revelations around the time of the intervention revealed that this intervention had been planned at least for 2 years prior to the actual movement of Kenyan troops into southern Somalia. That the United States Pentagon, through the United States Africa Command, AFRICOM, was very, very significant in not only planning but also coordinating the Kenyan Defense Forces intervention in southern Somalia. Kenya later became part of the African Union Force, the so-called African Union Mission to Somalia, AMISOM, that is bolstering Somalia's weak United Nations and U.S.-backed government against the al-Shabaab resistance organization. The United States State Department declared al-Shabaab as a terrorist organization as early as February of 2008. Also, additional information coming out of the Horn of African nation of Somalia on September the 6th. It indicates that Somalia's resistance organization, al-Shabaab, named a new leader after confirming the killing of their previous leader by a United States airstrike, a commander of the group revealed. The Somalia al-Shabaab organization unanimously selected Ahmed Omar, also known as Abu Abuda, at a meeting in an undisclosed location in Somalia, said the rebel commander, Abu Muhammad. Al-Shabaab also stated that it remains aligned with the Al-Qaeda network, according to the site intelligence group, which monitors statements by Islamist militant organizations. There had been speculation that Al-Shabaab would be shaken by a power struggle over the selection of a new leader and that perhaps the Somalia organization would change alliances and become allied to the Islamic State militant group, which accedes sections of territory in Syria and Iraq. The Somalia organization had to appoint a new leader after the death of Ahmed Abdi Godani, who was killed with two other officials by a United States airstrike just this last past Monday, September the 1st. The attack took place 105 miles south of Mogadishu, where Al-Shabaab has a military training facility. Quote, avenging the death of our scholar and leader is a binding obligation on our shoulders that we will never relinquish nor forget, no matter how long it takes, unquote, said a statement issued by Al-Shabaab. President Obama confirmed on Friday that Godani was killed by a Pentagon airstrike. The State Department declared this organization persona non grata. They declared them a terrorist organization over 6 years ago. And this is not the first time that the United States has engaged in drone attacks and other forms of offensive aerial bombardments in Somalia. These attacks extend back at least until the beginning of 2007. Of course, at that time, the resistance was being led by what was known as the Islamic Courts Union. A section of the Islamic Courts Unions, a year later, was coaxed into joining the Somali federal government. Nonetheless, Al-Shabaab, which means the youth in Arabic, decided to continue the struggle until all foreign forces backed by the United States and the European Union were forced to leave the Horn of Africa nation. The United States has offered a reward of up to $7 million for information leading to the arrest of the leader of the Al-Shabaab organization who was supposedly killed on September the 1st. Godani claimed Al-Shabaab was responsible for last year's deadly Westgate Mall attack in Nairobi that left at least 67 people dead in retaliation for the presence of Kenyan Defense Forces troops occupying southern Somalia. Somalia's government said on Friday night that it has incredible intelligence that Al-Shabaab is planning additional attacks in retaliation for Godani's death. According to General Khalif Ahmed Ereg, who is the Somalia National Security Minister, these attacks will be carried out against educational as well as medical facilities. And of course, the Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta, who has been involved in carrying out the war in southern Somalia, stated very clearly that he was delighted by this U.S. military action against the regime of Al-Shabaab, which controls large swaths of territory in central and southern Somalia. In fact, they have tens of thousands of fighters under their command. And of course, the situation in Somalia is very much a part of the United States' overall strategy in East Africa. The United States maintains a CIA field station in the capital of Mogadishu in Somalia. They also have drone operations that are carried out in Somalia, as well as utilizing neighboring Ethiopia as a base, as well as neighboring Djibouti, also in the Horn of Africa. In Djibouti, at the Camp Le Monaire, the United States maintains a military base with thousands of its military forces there as part of a strike force that can be deployed anywhere throughout the East Africa region. Also off the coast of the Horn of Africa, in the Gulf of Aden, as well as in the Indian Ocean, there are flotillas of warships from the United States, from the European Union, and other countries that have been present there now for at least 6 years. This militarization of East Africa and the Horn of Africa are part and parcel of the overall military strategy of the United States Africa Command, AFRICOM. AFRICOM, which was founded under the previous government of President George W. Bush in 2008, under the contemporary government of President Barack Obama, AFRICOM has been strengthened and enhanced. Funding for the operations have been accelerated. And the aggressive character of AFRICOM on the part of the United States imperialism has become much more pronounced and protracted. Despite the fact that the Obama administration held a White House Africa summit, which took place in early August, in order to woo various African heads of state to have a more favorable view of the United States and the current government of President Barack Obama, the aggressive military operations against deemed and purported enemies of Washington and Wall Street on the African continent will inevitably escalate. And with that, we're going to take another brief break. We'll be right back with more of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. And welcome back. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, held a summit recently in Newport in Cardiff, Wales. The summit was the focus of the United States, which is the founder and leader of NATO, and its overall strategy, particularly towards the Middle East, as well as towards Ukraine and Russia. According to a report published in the September 7th edition of the ITAR TASS news agency based in Moscow, it indicates that two NATO warships, the Canada's frigate Toronto and Spain's frigate Almirante Juan de Bourbon, have entered the Black Sea to take part in the international drill Sea Breeze 2014, a military diplomatic source told ITAR TASS on Sunday, September the 7th. Quote, both ships passed through Bosphorus and entered the Black Sea on Saturday evening, unquote, the source said. On Friday, September the 5th, another two NATO warships, as the French Navy shipment commanded Bureau and the U.S. destroyer Ross, also entered the Black Sea. France's ship Dupuy-Le-Lome, that had been staying in the Black Sea from August the 16th, left from the Mediterranean Sea on September the 5th. Quote, the NATO ship's crew will conduct the Sea Breeze exercise from September 8th to September the 10th. It is expected that along with the four above-mentioned ships, the drills will involve Turkey's frigate, Faruk Reis, Romania's frigate, Regele Ferdinand, and Georgia's patrol boat, the Sukhumi, unquote. The source added, quote, while staying in the Black Sea, the alliance warship may call at the ports of Constanța in Romania and Odessa in the Ukraine, unquote. According to the official website of the Ukrainian Defense Ministry, Ukraine will commission five warships and support vessels and two border services boats to the exercises. Apart from that, the drills will involve planes and helicopters of the Ukrainian Armed Forces Naval Aviation. The drills will be monitored by observers from a number of countries, namely Georgia, Norway, Sweden, and France. In line with the Montreux Convention, warships of non-littoral states cannot stay in the Black Sea for more than 21 days. France's Dupuy-Le-Lome stayed in the Black Sea 21 days. Hence, the convention was not violated. And what does all this mean? It means that the United States and its allies within the NATO organization is escalating its aggressive military policies aimed specifically at the Russian Federation. Now, of course, there was a ceasefire that was negotiated right on the eve of the NATO summit that took place last week in Wales. The NATO summit, of course, resulted in an alliance of some 10 countries committed to escalating military aggression against Russia and also against those who are sympathetic to Russia in eastern Ukraine. Now, of course, this ceasefire appears to be holding in many cases, but at the same time, on Sunday, September the 7th, it was revealed that the actual ceasefire may be tenuous. According to a report from RT, firefighting has been reported near Donetsk Airport while shelling is being heard in the city of Mariupol. The city authorities blame so-called pro-Russian rebels for the violence, who say Kiev troops have launched artillery strikes against their positions. Sporadic shooting and artillery fire have been reported near and in the southeastern Ukrainian city of Mariupol despite the ceasefire, with both local self-defense forces and Ukrainian military troops accusing each other of breaching the truce. Reuters cited an unnamed Ukrainian officer saying there has been an artillery attack on Mariupol, which Kiev forces are occupying at the moment. A woman has died in hospital as a result of overnight shelling in Mariupol, making hers the first death since the ceasefire came into force on Friday, September the 5th, local officials said in a statement. Another three residents were also wounded when pro-Russian forces opened fire on a government-held checkpoint at the eastern edge of the city, they added. Witnesses, meanwhile, told the ETAR TASS news agency that Ukrainian troops in Mariupol are regrouping and receiving reinforcements from Kiev. A defense minister of the Donetsk People's Republic, Vladimir Kononov, has warned that if the armed provocations from the Ukrainian troops do not stop, the armed forces of the republic reserve the right to open fire in return. The Donetsk People's Republic has grown up in opposition to the U.S.-backed and fascist-supported regime based in the western part of Ukraine in Kiev. According to Kononov, and he told this to the RIA news agency, that, quote, Ukrainian forces continue shelling our positions. It appears that President Poroshenko does not control his troops in full. The aim of the ceasefire is for Kiev to regroup and launch an offensive. We're ready for this, unquote, Kononov said. He went on to say that, quote, if provocations continue, I'll be forced to issue an order to reciprocate with deadly force, unquote. There have been reports about skirmishes near Donetsk International Airport, where a group of armed men of unknown national identity has been holed up for quite some time. Rockets destroyed several houses in the village of Spartak, north of Donetsk, reports RT's Paula Sleer, who was working at the site when the attack began. Quote, driving past entire rows of houses that have gone up in smoke, unquote, she tweeted. Fire brigades were putting out flames while the locals assisted them by pouring buckets of water, which sometimes made no difference as the shelling left almost nothing. RT's crew had to leave the village for security reasons, quote, driving like mad, unquote, to escape possible renewal of the shelling. They returned to Donetsk city center, quote, life here carries on as normal, unquote, Sleer wrote on Sunday, September the 7th. A militia checkpoint in Zhivka to the north of Donetsk has suffered an assault as well, which resulted in casualties. Several settlements, as well as the Donetsk suburb of Avdiivka and Makiivka, all suffered artillery strikes, with at least one casualty reported. Ukrainian forces attempted to seize Pervomaysk settlement, but were repelled, Donetsk rebels said on their website. The Ukrainian army used tanks, mortars, cannons, and grade multiple launchers to deliver strikes on militia-controlled settlements, the rebels claim. A number of households have been destroyed. Militia artillery returned fire, eliminating several Ukrainian gun squads. The deputy prime minister of the self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic, Andrei Pergin, told the RIA news agency that despite provocations by the Ukrainian troops, the self-defense militias is going to, quote, stick firmly to the Minsk agreements and will not put in arms and will not put arms to use, unquote, he said. The militias say that on Sunday morning, September the 7th, Ukrainian forces were concentrating a large number of troops and military hardware near Golovka, some 48 kilometers from the city of Donetsk. A long convoy of military vehicles allegedly traveled the road connecting Mironovka and Debalaslavo settlements. The Luhansk militia released two Ukrainian prisoners of war on Sunday, September the 7th, as part of the Minsk agreement. The United Nations News Agency reported, citing Poroshenko's press secretary, Yavtoslav Segorko, rebels in Donetsk reportedly freed 15 Ukrainian troops. Self-defense militias and their intelligence forces shared information that the Ukrainian troops concentrated near Donetsk possesses at least 47 tanks, 15 Shoka arms self-propelled anti-aircraft vehicles, 7 Toshka U NATO-designated SCARB tactical ballistic missile complexes, 6-grade multiple rocket launch complexes, and 1 SMERSH heavy multiple rocket launcher. This information has, however, not been verified. If the ceasefire fails, the government does not rule out the possibility of imposing martial law in eastern Ukraine. Quote, if this ceasefire ends like all the other previous ceasefires ended, and not in Ukraine only, there will be no other option, unquote, Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk told the 1+1 TV channel. And, of course, the ceasefire is shaky, even according to the New York Times. From the September 7th edition, an article penned by David M. Hersenhorn indicated that scattered fighting threatened a shaky ceasefire in eastern Ukraine on September the 7th, as officials now confront a task even more formidable than maintaining the truce, and that's fashioning some form of decentralized governance in the war-ravaged region that President Vladimir Putin of Russia will accept, and that President Petro old Poroshenko of Ukraine can deliver without turning his country against him. But just 2 days after the truce was signed in Minsk, Belarus, calling for, quote, decentralization of power, unquote, as the most important step after a halt to the violence, Yuri V. Lutsenko, an influential advisor to Poroshenko, published an article Sunday denouncing the idea of creating a special autonomous zone in the east, which Russia has demanded, saying it would be, quote, a cancerous tumor in the Ukrainian organism, unquote. The article on the Ukrainian Pravda news site by Lutsenko, who is leading Poroshenko's political party in a bid to win control of parliament in elections next month, underscored the enormous challenge in defusing a crisis that has escalated tensions between Russia and the West to the highest level since the end of the so-called Cold War. Deep mistrust on all sides has sharply increased the possibility of a lengthy standoff if further hostilities are to be avoided. Despite Russia's official position that it is not a party to the conflict in the eastern Ukraine, the Kremlin has laid out in writing its demands for a new political system in Ukraine, including a new constitution that would turn the country into a federation of largely autonomous regions and enshrine its, quote, neutral military political status, unquote, precluding membership in NATO. The Ukrainian government's plan would maintain a strong central government in Kiev and increase the budget authority of local governments while constraining the role of regional governments, a step to prevent the possibility of powerful regional officials with greater loyalty to Moscow. In addition to the assurances about NATO membership and the Kremlin's demands that regional autonomy goes beyond what the Kiev government has proposed, political analysts say any agreement between Ukraine and pro-Russian organizations in the east of the country would likely have to include some concessions to the Russian Federation regarding the implementation of a new free trade agreement between Ukraine and the European Union, perhaps establishing a special trade relationship between Russia and eastern Ukraine. Therefore, we see that the situation inside of eastern Ukraine, on the border with the Russian Federation, is a very volatile one. And it remains to be seen if this ceasefire agreement that was reached in Minsk in Belarus just last week will be honored by the U.S.-backed government in Kiev in the western region of Ukraine. And to what degree this new coalition put together by the United States, a so-called new coalition of the willing, involving 10 imperialist states to bolster U.S. aggressive military activity as it relates to both Ukraine as well as the Middle Eastern nation of Iraq. And concluding this week's Pan-African Journal, we'd like to discuss the current situation in Iraq, where the United States has escalated aggressive military actions, principally in the north of the country. It says, according to a report by Michael Moloff, that President Barack Obama is looking for help from a coalition of Sunni-majority countries to resist the Islamic State, or ISIS. The consensus among regional analysts and military experts is that it won't work. Obama has been pushing at the recent NATO summit for the formation of a coalition to resist ISIS, but Great Britain has been stressing such a force should not be Western-led. United States Secretary of State John Kerry and other administration officials have in turn been reaching out to nations across the Middle East. Many of the key Sunni countries, in fact the monarchies and pro-NATO elements and the NATO member Turkey, these include, of course, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, however, not only channel money to ISIS, but also have militaries inferior, particularly in command and control and tactical maneuvering to ISIS capabilities and its fanaticism and ferocity on the battlefield. ISIS was able to score early battlefield successes against an Iraqi army that initially scattered upon being attacked, abandoning much of its modern and expensive Western military equipment that came under the control of the Islamic State. These developments came after the United States over a decade had spent hundreds of billions of dollars to train and equip the Iraqi army, only to have it evaporate on ISIS' initial assault into the country last June. The acquisition of powerful military hardware, along with its takeover of oil wells and the robbing of banks approaching $1 billion, allowed the Sunni jihadist group to incorporate vast amounts of territory, military bases, and other strategic infrastructural facilities, which the Iraqi army now finds difficult, if not impossible, to retrieve. Military experts point out that ISIS already has begun to adapt to air power attacks from the United States and even Syria, which has attacked ISIS positions around Raqqa, a Syrian city the ISIS announced as capital of its caliphate, under which all like-minded extremist Sunnis are expected to live under strict Sharia law or be killed. While Western air power attacks have in some ways blunted ISIS advances in recent weeks, particularly around critical strategic locations such as dams in Iraq, ISIS is modifying its approach away from the large convoys of vehicles that expose its position to artillery fire. So what does this say? It says, on the one hand, that the Obama administration, along with 9 other NATO countries, are going to intensify both aerial as well as ground operations in northern Iraq. And it is also indicating that they may be in for a much more protracted and a much more militarily involved struggle than they had initially anticipated. And what does this mean for the people of the United States, who for the last 23 years have been involved in at least 3 major military operations against the Middle Eastern nation of Iraq? It also opens the way for the potential bombing by the United States of positions alleged to be controlled by the Islamic State inside of Syria. Even a year later, after efforts by the Obama administration to carry out broad aerial bombardments against the Syrian government in an effort to topple the President Bashar al-Assad, with the role of Russia and China and others on the Security Council, even within the British Parliament, opposition arose, forcing Prime Minister David Cameron to back down. The U.S. now appears to be working on a different angle, to carry out offensive military operations against Syria and at the same time to reopen a new military front against the Middle Eastern nation of Iraq. In concluding this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal, we'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire, which the Pan-African Journal is largely based upon, is an international electronic press service designed to foster intelligent discussion on the affairs of African people throughout the African continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998 and has published thousands of articles and dispatches in newspapers and magazines and journals and research reports on blogs and on websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. And if you want to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, go to the following URL, and that's at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. This is Abayomi Ezekwe signing off, and have a beautiful week. And welcome back. This is the Pan-African Journal. We are here on Saturday, September 13th, 2014, broadcasting live from our studios here in downtown Detroit. We just heard the New York City version of the Pan-African Journal aired just this last past week on Community Progressive Radio in New York City. And that program was hosted by yours truly, Abayomi Ezekwe, and produced by Bernard White of Community Progressive Radio, CPRMetro.org. And coming up in the next segment of the Pan-African Journal, we'll be commemorating the 33rd anniversary of the Attica Prison Rebellion of September of 1971. The Attica Prison Rebellion gained national and international attention during 1971, resulting in the storming of the prison by the state police under the direction of Nelson Rockefeller, who was governor of the state of state of New York during 1971. And we'll be right back with more of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. And once again, let us listen to the one and only voice of the voiceless, Mumia Abu-Jamal.
War by another name. With the rapid strikes and seizures of Iraqi territory by the Islamic State, commonly known as ISIS, the West, given a splendid pretext by the horrific decapitations of two journalists, is mounting a counterattack, if only by air. So far, no Western state has yet announced the deployment of ground troops. Why are they there? They claim that ISIS is a threat to their homelands, surely a stretch by any honest measure. For ISIS has, according to most accounts, 20,000 troops, at best, according to some sources, 10,000. According to the International Institute for Strategic Studies, Iraq has 247,000 active troops, well over 20 times ISIS's troop strength. ISIS has no air force, nor navy, nor tanks, except those left behind in Iraqi bases by their fleeing troops. How then is ISIS an imminent threat to the U.S., not to mention the West? They have an aggressive and able armed force. But how could they roust Iraqi troops so easily, unless Iraqis had little to fight for in the first place? Truth is, it's hard to fight for a puppet. And although former Prime Minister Nouri Kamel al-Maliki is no longer in power, a U.S. puppet still runs Iraq. The real reason U.S. troops withdrew from Iraq had nothing to do with the Iraqi people. It withdrew because al-Maliki refused to sign a so-called status of force agreement, a pact granting U.S. troops total immunity for any action committed on Iraqi lands. Any action? The idea is breathtaking. Even a puppet couldn't bear it. And now, to protect their puppet state, the U.S. bombs Iraqi targets described as ISIS hotspots. But bombs are weapons of war, not tools of peace. Call it what you will, it's still war. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And that was Mumia Abu-Jamal, the voice of the voiceless, talking about the latest U.S. military war drive yet again in the Middle Eastern state of Iraq. And, of course, this new set of pronouncements by the Obama administration clearly represents the failure of U.S. foreign policy towards Iraq over the last quarter century. And right now, let's listen to another commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal on the recently passed Labor Day 2014.
Labor Days. What is Labor Day 2014? A day like all other days, not in honor of workers, but in cruel irony of workers' impotence and defeat. Yeah, celebrate Labor Day, sure. But attack unions, denigrate union organizing, while calling for wage cuts and deregulation. Witness today's unprecedented assault on teachers and their unions. They're called lazy and incompetent. And even Hollywood joins the fray with a recent movie. Remember Bad Teacher? You think you'll be seeing Bad CEO anytime soon? I didn't think so. Once again, Hollywood sides with the powerful whilst being labeled liberal. Workers are working harder today and getting considerably less in return. Wages are low, and respect for working people is even lower. Unions are demonized. Labor Day, a day like all others, when labor and its unions are spit on. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And that was Mumia Abu-Jamal speaking on the state of labor in the United States. And we're going to take a brief break, and we'll be right back with our documentary on the anniversary of the 1971 Attica Prison Rebellion. That was the sound of the Marvelettes from Motown during the 1960s. And right now we're going to move into our audio documentary commemorating the the 33rd anniversary of the Attica Prison Rebellion. It occurred at the Attica Correctional Facility in Attica, New York, in the United States in 1971. The rebellion is one of the most famous and important rebellions during the prisoners' rights movement. The rebellion was based upon prisoners' demands for political rights and better living conditions. On September the 9th of 1971, just 2 weeks after the assassination of George Jackson in San Quentin in California, about 1,000 of the Attica prisoners, of approximately 2,200 inmates, rebelled and seized control of the prison, taking 42 prison guards and other officials hostage. And right now, let's listen in to this program commemorating the 33rd anniversary of the Attica Prison Rebellion.
Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to another edition of From the Vault, the Archives weekly program that takes our history out of the vault and onto the radio. This week we listen to the historic Pacifica radio coverage of the bloodiest prison confrontation in American history. September 9th, 1971 marked the beginning of the Attica Prison Rebellion. Nearly 1,500 prisoners revolted and held 40 guards hostage while the world awaited the reason for this uprising. Prisoner L.D. Barkley would break the silence on WBAI radio in New York City.
The entire incident that has erupted here at Attica is not a result of the dastardly bushwhacking of the two prisoners September 8th of 1971. But of the unmitigated oppression wrought by the racist administrative network of this prison throughout the year. We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be beaten or driven as such. What has happened here is but the sound before the fury of those who are oppressed. We call upon all the conscientious citizens of America to assist us in putting an end to this situation that threatens the lives of not only us, but of each and every one of you as well.
The prisoners had authored a manifesto issuing demands for improvements on inhumane living conditions, as well as establishing educational and career training opportunities. 4 days of negotiations ended, and New York State Police and National Guard troops assaulted the rebel prison block. When the smoke cleared, the death toll was 33 prisoners and 10 of the prison guards held hostage. Pacifica's coverage of these 5 chilling days brought into focus a world behind bars that the American public created. The origins of the tragedy of Attica can be traced to conditions inside the prison that very few people were aware of, unless they spent time behind Attica's gates or listened to Pacifica's broadcast. Following the September 13th siege of the prison, all alleged rebel leaders were locked down in 24-hour isolation cells. In February of 1972, Attica began allowing the press to speak to the prisoners. Prisoner Donald Noble, who was responsible for saving the life of hostage Michael Smith when the troops stormed the prison, spoke with WBAI producer Bruce Soloway about the living conditions inside the prison before the rebellion started.
They said the food is all bad. Like one time a guy called an officer over, told the officer there was a worm in the soup, you know. The officer said, well, don't say nothing because you're lucky, at least you got some meat, you know, and all this type of thing, you know. But all these are the conditions that you live here, you know.
Toilet
gotta go as well. You get a roll of toilet paper once a month. You don't get no toothpaste or toothbrush or anything like that. Now, since this disturbance, they started coming around letting you know that if you want some toothpaste, toothbrush, that to turn in the old toothbrush and turn in the old toothpaste, and you will get them. All they say you start getting after the disturbance. But up the line, you wasn't getting this, and you still get the toilet paper like once a month. But these are the conditions that you live here. Same thing like in the metal shop where I was working at. Mr. Mills, the head director of industry from Albany, he came here. And everybody ran up to him with all kinds of complaints. You know, dealing with the shop, they had gas, they had paint masks up there, what wasn't good. Because when you use the paint gun, the fumes of it get in your system. And the people are showing them that the masses was no good and all this here. And they asked the doctor for some milk so they could kill these fumes. And this was, the doctor refused this here. So he said that he looked at the mass and seen that they was no good. So he said that he's going to speak to Oswell and try to get some different masses. But he's not for it.
Donald Noble was also one of the creators and authors of the Attica Manifesto. This document was originally written to Attica warden Vincent Mancusi to encourage prison reform within Attica. When Vincent Mancusi gave no indication that these reforms would ever take place under his term, they sent the list of 28 demands to New York State Corrections Commissioner Russell Oswald. Donald Noble describes this process.
Yes, well, I'm one of the men whose names are on a manifesto that was submitted to Oswald.
Tell me something about
it. Yeah, we submitted a manifesto, 28 demands to Oswald in July. And we also submit one to Rockefeller. We also submit one to Shirley Chisholm. We also submit one to Arthur Eve and different legislative people and lawyers and so forth. You know, we got a beautiful reply back from Oswald sometime in August. You know, he acknowledged our letter and so forth, you know, and he was enthused about the way the manifesto was drawn up because this was more or less coincided with his ideas, you know. And he stated that he's for all these changes that we talked about because he see that they are needed, you know, but to give him time. And everybody, you know, they went along with him because a lot of us had dealing with Oswald for years, you know, being behind, coming back and forth when he's sitting on the parole board. So then, different things, like there was things that all he had to do was more or less get in touch with the warden here that would have been went into effect, you know? You know, because it seemed like the way we see it, a lot of us, that when if he tells Mancusi, like, to do this here, Mancusi would say, hell with it, you know? I'm going to do my thing, you know, which wasn't nothing.
Perhaps broadcast only on Pacifica Radio in its entirety, prisoner L.D. Barkley reads the manifesto in Attica's central yard. Here it is. Unmediated.
To the people of the United States of America, first of all, we want it to be known that in the past we have had some very, very treacherous experiences with the Department of Correction in New York State. They have promised us many things, and they have given us nothing except more of what we already got. Brutalization, murder inside this penitentiary. We do not intend to accept or allow ourselves to accept this situation again. Therefore, we have composed this declaration to the people of America to let them know exactly how we feel and what it is that they must do and what we want primarily and not what someone else wants for us. We're talking about what we want. The entire, and then and again, it seems to be a little misunderstanding about why this incident developed here at Attica. And this declaration here will explain the reason. The entire incident that has erupted here at Attica is not a result of the dastardly bushwhacking of the two prisoners September 8th of 1971, but of the unmitigated oppression wrought by the racist administrative network of this prison throughout the year. We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be beaten or driven as such. The entire prison populace, that means each and every one of us here, have set forth to change forever the ruthless brutalization and disregard for the lives of the prisoners here and throughout the United States. What has happened here is but the sound before the fury of those who are oppressed. We will not compromise on any terms except those terms that are agreeable to us. We call upon all the conscientious citizens of America to assist us in putting an end to this situation that threatens the lives of not only us, but of each and every one of you as well. We have set forth demands that will bring us closer to the reality of the demise of these prison institutions that serve no useful purpose to the people of America, but to those who would enslave and exploit the people of America. Our demands are such. We want complete amnesty, meaning freedom from all and any physical, mental, and legal reprisals. We want now speedy and safe transportation out of confinement to a non-imperialistic country. We demand that the federal government intervene so that we will be under direct
federal jurisdiction. We want the governor and the judiciary, namely Constance B. Motley, to guarantee that there will be no reprisals. And we want all facets of the media to articulate this. We urgently demand immediate negotiations through William M. Kunstler, attorney at law, 588 9th Avenue, New York, New York. Assemblyman Arthur O'Eve of Buffalo. The Prison Solidarity Committee of New York, Minister Farrakhan from the Muslims. We want Huey P. Newton from the Black Panther Party, and we want the chairman of the Young Lord Party. We want Clarence B. Jones of the Amsterdam News. We want Tom Wicker of the New York Times. We want Richard Roth from the Courier Express. We want the Fortune Society. Dave Anderson of the Urban League of Rochester. Blind Eva Barnes. We want Jim Ingram of the Democratic Lit Chronicle of Detroit, Michigan. We guarantee the safe passage of all people to and from this institution. We invite all the people to come here and witness this degradation so that they can better know how to bring this degradation to an end. This is what we want. We
right
want
right
out.
Also, we want Joe Walker from Muhammad Speaks newspapers.
And we want this to be understood. All these people that we've asked for, we love them, and I believe they care something about us. And we don't want them here next year. We want them here now.
One of the people the prisoners asked to come and witness the negotiations was New York State Assembly member Arthur Eve, representing the 143rd District of Buffalo. Eve explains his role in the Attica Rebellion.
Well, I got there on Thursday when I heard over the wire services that the revolt had taken place. I immediately asked the commissioner to allow me to go in because no one had been in to talk with the inmates since the revolt had started. This was about 2 or 3 o'clock. Professor Herman Schwartz from the UB Law School, who had been working on prison legal matters, was there and, you know, said that he would go in also. So we went in as the first set of outsiders who went into DER. There the inmates gave me a list of their five set of demands, first five set points, in which one of them were that they wanted certain people to come to Attica to be observers. My name was one of them. The commissioner, no one ever called me, and I understand that they had given this to the state.
About how long before you came?
In fact, nobody called me. I imagine they, as soon as the revolt was taken over and they were able to sit down and type out a first set of those demands, that it was given to the state within a couple of hours or so. And I guess I got there maybe 3 or 4 hours. When they gave me that list, then I came out and talked with the commissioner about getting these people here, because the inmates said they would not negotiate until those people were there. The commissioner and the state only attempted to get a few, and they, Clarence Jones of the Amsterdam News was one of those that the governor flew in on a private plane, along with several other people. But I found that they were not attempting to get the other people, so I called my office, and they in turn called the Kunstler, the Black Panthers, the Young Lords, Tom Wick of the New York Times, even a guy from a local racist white newspaper in Buffalo that they, some of the inmates wanted, a guy named Charles Roth, who had evidently written a fairly fair story about prisons. They wanted Minister Farrakhan, Black Muslims. They wanted Prison Solidarity Committee. And it was, in fact, they wanted someone from the Urban League of Rochester, a guy named Dave Anderson, and a woman from a poverty program there in Niagara Falls, New York. And I think what it showed was that, you know, the various diverse political philosophies of all of the inmates, but everyone honored everyone else's request, and they were then made a composite list of people, representative of all the people in there, to come.
Assemblymember Arthur Eve describes how the prisoners would communicate with the state of New York.
And because the inmates had told us all along that we cannot negotiate for them, we cannot make any decisions for them, the observer groups, the best thing we could do was take a message out, since the state would not come in and negotiate with them, get a response, and just bring that back, okay? We cannot make any decisions. And, you know, we made that very clear every time we went out, that the best we could do was take a message back to the state and get the state to respond, and we would bring that back. But all decisions would be made by them, because it was their lives that decisions were being made on. And that's why I don't like people to call us negotiators as such. You know, we were an observer group that the men had invited, that whatever was finally negotiated on and agreed to by the state, that we would have been there to ensure that these things would have been implemented, you see, because they had been lied to at other, you know, at the Auburn situation, because I was involved after the Auburn disorders, and where the men had been promised certain things, and instead of getting them, all they had was reprisals. They were put in cells for 90 to 120 days at Auburn. So the men knew that the credibility of the state and the superintendent was very, very bad. But when Saturday came, Bobby Seals came, and all of us went in with Bobby along with the press. Each time we went, I want to repeat, the press went in. The press had opportunity to document everything that was said, you know, the interviews with the hostages, everything. But Bobby went in, and we all went in with Bobby, and we were told, you know, to come out when, you know, Bobby left. Bobby went in, talked with a few of the inmates, sort of the leadership, and got a picture of what was going on. And he said that he had to leave and come back and later the next morning, Sunday morning at 7, but he was going to talk to Brother Huey Newton and talk with the committee back in L.A., but, you know, he couldn't tell them what to do. He wasn't going to make any recommendation, you know.
Co-founder of the Black Panther Party, Bobby Seale.
Really what happened is that I went to Oakland, California, Sunday. Mm-hmm. I arrived in Oakland, California, West Coast time at 3 o'clock. West Coast time at 12 o'clock that same Sunday afternoon, I caught a plane back. Mm-hmm. This was the original intended plan in the first place. Went back to confer with the Central Committee of the Black Panther Party. We're not individualists in the party, and it's just one of those things where we have to have some kind of democratic centralized functions. And I reported to them the situation. I explained to the Central Committee that some more legal and political support was going to be necessary, and that the brothers had explained to me that they wanted me to hurry up and go to Oakland and come on back with any kind of negotiative guidance that they could decide on. These were the prisoners who told me this, the 22 minutes that I was inside the prison Saturday night prior to going to Oakland Sunday. I came back. Well, wait a minute. Let me back up a little bit. While I was there in Oakland, the Central Committee decided it was very necessary that right away I should get on the phone, try to contact William Kunstler inside the prison, and see if William Kunstler could get Oswald, the commissioner, on the phone. Mm-hmm. This was done. Oswald came on the phone, and I had told Oswald what the Central Committee said that I should tell Oswald. And what I told Oswald was basically that the prisoners had stated to me before I left that Saturday night while I was inside, the prisoners had stated to me that they would not kill or release any of the guards, at least until I return to help out with more negotiative guidance that they could decide on. Now, this is what the prisoners told me. Now, I told Oswald that. He says, well, what are you going to do? I said, I'm on my way back. I'll be there tomorrow morning.
Again, Arthur Eve.
I'd like to get to the Saturday night thing leading into Sunday morning, because this is a critical point. First of all, the inmates allowed and insisted that Officer Quinn, the one who ultimately died that Saturday, they insisted that the state send in a stretcher so that they could get him out of there, because they felt that he was had been seriously injured. The inmates insisted that a doctor be allowed to come in and to treat the hostages. The inmates gave the state a list of the hostages that they had, because from just observing, evidently the state hadn't even ascertained who the hostages were that they had in. The inmates provided that list and asked for medical records of each of the hostages that they had. And there were a number of hostages from 7 to 11 that were allowed to leave if they had a history of heart, you know, condition or asthmatic conditions or anything that might, in fact, staying inside might jeopardize their lives. So I want to make it very clear that the impression given that the inmates did not care about the hostages' lives and did, in fact, not treat them, you know, humane while they were inside. That is not so. In fact, the hostages slept on single and double mattresses while most of the inmates slept on the ground. The hostages were covered during the day by sort of a makeshift tent that they had built in order to protect them from the sun. And the doctor who volunteered, and I must commend this man, it was a white doctor, a surgeon who answered to the call for volunteer out of that whole area. And he was allowed to go in freely, back and out, without any stopping. In fact, when he went in, the inmates would lead him over to the hostages first, and he would always check them out first, and then he would look at some of the other inmates, because there were men in there who had asthmatic condition, heart conditions, and other things. And he said to the press that the inmates were taking better care of the hostages than they were themselves, that the hostages ate more, that they drank more, and they had more of everything. And the inmates were doing this. The state was not making that determination. So I want to get that straight from the very beginning.
From my people and comrades from Attica State Prison, they have informed us, we that try to serve our people, that an officer that has been mentioned by the press, which has been using rhetorics and trying to destroy what really, really happened, is that the officer died of a heart attack. Right? This officer was sent to the hospital by the prison administration. Later on, 2 days later, this officer passed away in the hospital. Now, this administration, run by Bancusi, and now who is in command, Oswald, and his supreme commander, Rockefeller, is trying to charge us with murder. This is not so. So we are, myself and our people in Attica, are trying to tell you that we did not murder this officer.
Arthur Eve explains how the state was using the media to publicly demonize the prisoners.
It's my understanding that there were only one sandwich per day for the
inmates. That's right. When the sandwiches were sent in, approximately 1,300 sandwiches, this is what they told us. Now, again, I don't know. They said approximately, the state was saying 13 sandwiches were going in. The inmates gave the hostages as much as they wanted to eat. If they felt two sandwiches were, you know, what they needed, they got two. Where the inmates at times had to divide, you know, and take a third of a sandwich or two-thirds or what. They rationed it out so that they then divided among themselves equally what was left after the hostages ate. And I want to make this very clear. They, you know, took very good care of them. To see the stories after I got out, you know, that had been written, you know, just was, you know, unbelievable. And I think it points up, you know, the inmates had a television set inside. They had a portable radio. And every time we went in, you know, they let the press come in. They insisted that, you know, all the major networks and everything else. And they had a pool out front where they would pick X number of guys to go in. And they knew the things that were being recorded. They knew the statements that were being made, you know, and the hostages were saying that they were being treated well and so forth, you know, and how they were being treated even better. And they should, you know, and they were shown the area. You know, the doctor told the news media how the hostages were being treated better and so forth. But then they saw on the TV tubes that this was not what was going out into the world. And they then, you know, knew that the system was again attempting to polarize and to make the outside world look upon them as, you know, animals or beasts or people who were not sensitive to human life. So, you know, all the days that they were in there, they knew that things would go back to the studios, be edited, and only those things that people wanted to use to further polarize this country was the things that were going out. So I want you to know that they were very well aware of the distortions, the, you know, untruths, and the kinds of editing that the major networks of this country and the news media were doing. So on Saturday, you know, in fact, when they said that Quinn was thrown out of a second-floor window, you know, and they said this Thursday, you know, when he was, you know, when he came out, they said it Friday, then he died Saturday, I believe, and, you know, the papers repeated it, thrown out of a second-floor window.
The claim by the administration is that the correction officer who died was thrown from a second floor window.
Say it out loud.
Will you answer that for the press, please?
Yes. I wish I had some kind of way to show you the bars in front of the window so you can understand and see for yourself, how can a man throw himself out a window while the bars, I know, larger than at least around 6 inches.
Well, if you've ever been in Attica and been at a maximum security penal institution, you know that there's bars on the first floor windows. You know, it's humanly impossible to throw a 200-pound man out of a second floor window in a prison, you see. But again, you know, the state did not correct these kinds of vicious lies because it was all part of their further polarization. Helping, hopefully, they felt, to give the public, you know, support for them to go in and to do ultimately what they did.
Perhaps most powerful were the sounds of the public pleas of the corrections officers being held hostage within the walls of Attica.
Whatever people they have on the roofs, outside, anybody with a weapon, anybody with anything of a militant manner, leave. Just get him off the rock.
How about the request that Governor Rockefeller make an appearance here?
I'd suggest he get his ass here now. I'd like to say this. I think I'm speaking for all of us. We're not scared of any of you people. We know it's not you hurting us, but the people outside, the governor, the people that elected the governor, and all the people in the United States, we're awaiting their decision, and we want to see them meet all your demands. Again, I say I really want, and we all want, the people on the roofs to get off.
Mike, in making the statement you just made that it's not the people in here who are hurting you, but it's the people outside, have you been coached to make that statement? Any pressure, any promise, anything of any kind?
But no.
Can you say something convincing in that regard? Because it will sound so to many people.
Yes, I think that the unity as one, white brothers, black brothers, Puerto Rican brothers, all you people show that you've got yourselves together. The mere fact that we haven't been injured.
Yeah, I have a family.
Yes, I have a wife. I have a daughter born May 26, 1971. I wish I could be home with them. We all wish we could be home. By we, I don't mean 38 of us. I mean all of us. All 1,538 of us.
When it was evident the state of New York was losing interest in negotiating, Attorney William Kunstler made a prediction on the state's next move.
Do you think they will really sacrifice the guards before they will agree to the demands of the prison?
Yeah, I had hoped the guards would not be expendable, but I think from the reaction here that they are expendable.
Did you say the guards are expendable?
If the governor's remarks mean that he won't come and intervene, then I come to the conclusion the guards' lives are expendable.
Do you think that Commissioner Oswald has another alternative?
Of course he has an alternative. Time. Just to wait. And prisoners said they would take no action whatsoever if they had more time. And it seemed to me that time, in all justice and humanity, should have been given. Time can make, you know, a lot of shades of difference in negotiation, and time can save lives. And I would think that no stone should have been unturned in order to save those lives. They want to kill 39 guards and 1,500 prisoners. That's one thing. If they have any respect for human life, time is a lot easier to buy than life.
In time, isn't the only way to get out of this really to grant the amnesty that they're asking?
Well, but there are shades of amnesty. There are ways to negotiate it. There are lots of things that could be done.
What's the shade of amnesty that might be acceptable to the prisoners?
The governor might promise commutation, immediate commutation. He might promise a certain limit on punishment. He might promise executive clemency, an executive pardon. I mean, there are a dozen different ways in which that cat could be skinned.
A few moments ago, state police troopers moved into the unsecured areas of the institution to restore order under specific orders to only use force to meet force or to protect the lives, if possible, of the hostages. At the same time, a riot control gas was dispersed at 9:48 by helicopters in an effort to immobilize persons in the unsecured area.
And the noise that you hear in the background right now is the riving up of the helicopters. And the time is 9:45. And I'm here. And I'm supposed to be reporting this, and I'm supposed to be unemotional. But my people, my brothers in there, are going to be slaughtered. And it's very difficult to be a professional reporter this time. Our consulate has been refused admittance, and now one is going off. One Army helicopter is taken off. That means that they are now beginning to attack. You don't have to be in Vietnam. Vietnam is here now. This is it.
Again, Arthur E.
All of us said we were getting ready to leave, and I was the last one to leave the prison because they provided transportation to the airport for all the legislators. And when I got outside, the newsmen stopped me and they said, Mr. E., what do you have to say? And my response to them was that I'd never understand to the day I die why the governor did not come and talk to us. I said, we didn't ask him to come and talk to the inmates. We didn't say come and talk about amnesty. We said, come and talk to us. And then I mentioned, I said, you know, this group included the three white conservative legislators from this area, Emory, Walkley, Senator McGowan, you know, Bobby Garcia, Herman Bedelio, myself, say Clarence Jones, who just bought the Amsterdam News, you know, for millions, you know. I said, Tom Wick of the New York Times, I said, plus other people, Senator John Dunn, you know, we all asked him to come and talk to us to stop a massacre, you know. And I said, I'll never understand why, you know, the man did not come.
Early in his career, comedian Richard Pryor was broadcasting that summer on Pacifica radio station KPFA in Berkeley, California. He edited a series of New York State Correction Commissioner Russell Oswald statements on Attica to create this bit that aired that weekend following Attica in September of 1971.
We have some interesting things for you tonight. This is a little thing that Alan Farley and I worked out together. It's a comedy album. It's not been released yet, but it's going to be a monster. I think it's called The Button-Down Mind of Russell Oswald. famous Attica comedian. And I guess we're here now.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the star of our show, the funny man himself, Mr. Decision Maker, Mr. Oswald!
Let's see if I can review for you, if I can, a few of the things that entered into this most agonizing and decision I've probably ever made in my life. In any emergency of this kind, the state police would lead the way in, because it was always assumed that, and I don't know whether it's a proper assumption or not, but it was always assumed that correction officers, being embroiled in a situation such as this, might be vindictive. In going in, and the state police, who are a tremendously well-disciplined and a fine organization, would go in coolly and Forty killed, as you know. There are maybe another 300 who have some bruises.
How did that false report, that so, I think, inflamed the public generally and everybody, that hostages had their throats cut, how did that thing get started?
Well, I've tried to reconstruct that myself. I would say now, at the outset, that our own department, on occasions, did not report as well as we might have. It was under tremendous tensions, tremendous pressures. People were reporting at all times, no time to verify. The press was interviewing almost anyone who came out of the institution who looked like an official or an unofficial visitor there. There was a story put out by a guard that these throats had been cut. There was a story put out by a police sergeant that these throats had been cut. I believe one of my staff said the throats had been cut. Someone said I said they had. And so far as I know, no one has been able to prove to me yet that I did. I hope I didn't. Someone said I said they had.
The leaders never returned, but callously herded 8 hostages within our view with weapons at their throat.
Someone said I said they had. And so far as I know, no one has been able to prove to me yet that I did. I hope I didn't.
Callously herded 8 hostages within our view with weapons at their throat.
Someone said I said they had.
Callously herded 8 hostages within our view.
Someone said I said they had. And so far as I know, no one has been able to prove to me yet that I did. I hope I didn't.
Callously herded 8 hostages within our view with weapons at their throat.
I believe one of my staff said the throats had been cut. Someone said I said they had. And so far as I know, no one has been able to prove to me yet that I did. I hope I didn't.
Hard to believe, isn't it?
I saw a sniper from the state police who told me that a man was pulling a knife across this inmate's throat. Just as the takeover of the institution was begun, and that as he pulled the knife across the throat, he had about this much of the back of him showing, and he felt he had to get him, and he killed him. and he killed him, and he killed him, and he killed him, and he killed him, and he killed him. And that man came into my office thereafter and was shown on TV, as you may know.
The one
and his throat was badly cut. Now, I did see... correction.
You meant a hostage. You said an inmate.
A hostage. I'm sorry. Several of the hostages had had their blindfolds dropped around their neck, had been shot in the head. It was all bloody around the blindfolds. This was given to me by the pathologist. There was a sense of confusion. Certainly no deliberate attempt to deceive, because the facts would come out anyhow. One has to be prepared for possible difficulties. I think without question that there are some of these hardcore Maoists who would love to start the thing up again, and who will get support and what help they can from people on the outside. Some of the things those prisoners asked for, you and I, you would be shocked to think that they weren't getting. For instance, how would you like it if you were told that you could only have a shower 52 times a year? How would you like it if you only got a roll of toilet paper every 5 weeks? How would you like it if you spent 16 hours, or 60% of your time is what I want to say, in a cell? One can't rehabilitate people by keeping them in cells.
Hard to believe, isn't it?
How, Mr. Oswald, would you handle a situation if there were an addict at a mark?
I don't know. I really and truly don't know. I don't know. I really and truly don't know. It would be easy to say I'd do the same thing again, but I don't know. It's never the same situation. You know, there are always some variables. And I would have to look at it if it came. And God forbid that another one comes anywhere in the country. I pity the poor person who has to go through that kind of decision at any time.
It has indeed been an agonizing decision. I pray to God that this works out for the best interest of all of us.
Hard to believe, isn't it?
I pray to God.
For you don't count the dead when God's on your side.
But this works out for the best interest of all of us.
Hope you like that.
After a week of interviewing inmates, the National Lawyers Guild held a press conference outside the prison wall. The speakers for the Lawyers Guild were Jeffrey Haas and Joshua Roth.
Now, many of the general circumstances of the massacre of September 13th have already been made public. At this time, we have sufficient corroborating evidence to substantiate that inmate Frank Hicks was deliberately singled out and killed after he had surrendered and been placed in custody. Our evidence shows that after the yard was secured, Hicks was singled out by name and separated from the other prisoners. An X was placed on his back, and he was led into a cell block by prison guards and troopers. He was never seen alive again. His name appears among the reported dead. The only conclusion that we can make is that he was executed. In securing the institution, state troopers and prison guards had been led to believe, from statements released by prison officials, that several of the hostages had their throats slashed and that at least one hostage had been castrated. These lies further embittered and enraged the guards and troopers who had been waiting for 5 days at the gates of Attica for orders to go in. Their bitterness and rage was exercised on the inmates in the shootings, assassinations, and systematic beatings which followed. The brutality on September 13th was accompanied by constant references to the statements of prison officials, which had and still so poisoned the minds of the guards that they continue to terrorize the prisoners in spite of the results of the 3 autopsy reports, which totally contradict the official statements. Governor Rockefeller and prison officials provoked the police riot, which caused the deaths of 41 persons and the shootings and beatings of hundreds more. We hereby call for the indictment of Governor Rockefeller, Commissioner Oswald, Deputy Commissioner Dunbar, Warden and Warden Mancusi, and Deputy Warden Vincent for assault, mayhem, and murder. We'd also like to make some observations that the persons in Attica risked their lives to expose the conditions here and in other American prisons. That the response of the governor and other officials is not to deal with the conditions and the terribleness of the conditions which was raised, but it is to silence and punish the persons who raised those issues.
Rockefeller, I think he is a complete murderer. Nothing else but a murderer. I know I suffered in all these weeks and everything since. I hope this man never has another peaceful night's sleep. Never. Never.
Attorney William Kunstler reflects on the lessons learned from Attica from this talk recorded in 1973.
The other night at the law school at UB, there was a symposium in which I and a judge from Detroit Recorder's Court, Justin Ravitz, appeared, and there was a police officer by the name of Kirkland. And Mr. Kirkland got up and said, "There's one lesson that you better learn fast, that whether a man or a woman has a good job or no job, they get equally hungry. And that when they are hungry and they have no job, they are not going to die without a struggle. They're going to seize food. Very few of us really starved or even hungered. Virtually every want is in some way met. There isn't a gnawing feeling of eternal oppression. There isn't the reaction day in and day out of being despised, or at least feeling that you're being despised. There aren't the psychological trauma and the physical trauma
of every day's living as a black person or a poor white or a Chicano field hand or a Puerto Rican in Spanish Harlem or a Native American or a woman, and not feeling a great deal of this, and not wanting to feel it, or not being capable of feeling it, leads us into making these nice distinctions. They should have used more peaceful means of expression. And yet, in our secret hearts, we understand that no one, probably in this room or this city or this state or this nation, would have ever given essentially one day's thought to prison conditions had it not been for those 43 deaths, that no one would really even feel the first twinge of understanding of what Native Americans go through had it not been for Wounded Knee. And the question, that's a hard one to answer for everyone, is when will people fight, kill, die, go into the valley for what they believe in and what they need? And when will the outside world begin to understand that this drive for survival is so powerful and so irresistible and so much a natural part of human or animal life that people will go to any length to preserve themselves and their brothers and sisters, and that to talk philosophically about it or abstractly has no meaning, whether you're talking about Palestinian Arabs or the people of Ulster and the Irish Republic or of people in Vietnam or in any of the former Portuguese colonies, or in Rhodesia, and the Union of South Africa, and so many other places that crop up in the newspapers almost as if they are a regular progression of each other. And not to understand it is to lead to greater tragedy, because the countervalue is to oppose it with force. The countervalue is to destroy it without concerning yourself with its validity, its reasons for being.
And we end this program with comments again from New York State Assembly member Arthur Eve.
But I want to say this to the brothers, especially blacks and Puerto Ricans, you know, those inmates said, you know, get yourself some knowledge, get your minds together, you know, unite, you know, that we've got to be in every place. Those men understood revolution. They knew that here they invited me, a man who was somewhat a part of the system as far as a public official, you know, but they knew that everyone, if they have commitment, this is why education is so important to us, because if we don't get a good education, if we go through a genocide murdering system as they do, I'm sure, in the schools in New York, as they do in Buffalo, because they're just killing our kids through the Buffalo public school system, you know, that they can't even begin to seek knowledge and truth, you see. And this is why it's important that we own radio stations, you know, that we own newspapers, that we own TV stations, so that the truth, you see, not the edited stuff that comes out to us, get out, you see. But You know, I made a commitment to the inmates, and they said to us, go out and tell the truth. And they said, tell nothing but the truth. Okay, don't add to it, don't distract, and that's why, you know, everything I'm telling you, and if I say that, you know, this is something I assume or something, I will say that. But other than that, everything that I've said has been what I saw, what I experienced, and what was told to me by Deputy Commissioner Walter Dunbar. Okay, now, you know, this has been confirmed by Bobby Garcia and the Herman Bedelio as far as what happened after it was all over. And I think that, you know, if I can live just long enough to tell it to as many people, and hopefully that we, even those 10 hostages who died, their families realized that they were expendable, that the governor really didn't give a damn about them, and that if the governor's brother or son or daughter or relative had been in there, just one of them, not 38 hostages, I'm sure he would have come to Attica to talk to the Observer Committee. But they've proved that the ruling class, the ones who own the corporations, I'm not talking about the blacks who think they're making 40 or 100,000 a year, 200,000 a year, that they're part of the ruling class. You know, they're just fooling themselves, okay? They're just fooling themselves. I own a black newspaper. You know, I'm a state assemblyman, you know, I thought I was an important, you know, that, you know, that the mayor wouldn't dare, you know, do something like that to me, you know. And, you know, even though I've been saying that he's not sensitive to human life, I didn't realize to what extent, you see. So the message is that all oppressed people, if you work for any kind of living, you're part of the expendable group, you know. And I think this is something that we must realize, that the country is going towards a fascist form of government. New York State was leading the nation in the transition. And that when you take repression coupled with fear, that political equation is fascist form of government. And we are so close to it that it's unbelievable. And that we will only survive if by pulling ourselves together, utilizing every group and every talent that we have, and making this system responsive to human life, or else we're all dead. We're all dead.
And that does it for this week's edition of From the Vault, marking the anniversary of the 1971 Attica Prison Rebellion. We'd like to thank TalkingHistory.org for making the raw Pacifica coverage of the event available to the public and for contextualizing the subject that helped shape today's program. Stay tuned for future programs on the 1968 founding of the American Indian Movement, a rare find of poet Charles Bukowski, and more from the 1975 San Diego Folk Music Festival. This series is produced by Brian DeShazer and Mark Torres, and executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and Brian DeShazer. Today's program was written by Mark Torres. We are now streaming and podcasting online at fromthevaultradio.org. For more information or to join us in our efforts to preserve more of the historic collection, visit us at PacificaRadioArchives.org or call the archives at 1-800-735-0230. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported